Welcome, dear viewers, listeners, readers, etc. Welcome to what will be my fourth episode of Valhalla Conversations, as I'm officially titling this random series of remarkable panellists I keep pulling together on all my Norse favourite topics. And today's topic is a big review, debate, critique, sharing of thoughts and ideas on the rather remarkable, I think, series called Ragnarok on Netflix, which, to summarise, is basically an adaptation in many ways of Norse myths set in the modern world and quite aptly set in Norway. And there's three seasons of it. We do recommend you all go watch it after this panel. And there will be spoilers because we are discussing more or less all three seasons within this one episode. And I'm delighted that I've been joined not by four, but by five wonderful panelists, all with their own passion and expertise and knowledge of Norse mythology in their, both their works, both fictionally and in the non-fiction academic world as well. So we shall go round and each of the panellists will introduce themselves and of course mention any books that you might want dear readers and viewers to buy, purchase and browse. I have a few of them on the shelf behind me, just about seat behind my head. So Caroline Larrington, would you mind introducing yourself, please?
Of course. Well, I'm Caroline Larrington and I've just retired from teaching medieval English literature at the University of Oxford. But I'm still researching away, and one of my principal research interests is Old Norse myth and legend. I've published a couple of books on Old Norse myth for the trade market, The Norse Myths from 2017, and just came out last year, The Old Norse Myths That Shape the Way We Think, which is very much to do with the way that Norse story has been received in the modern world. I also translated the Old Norse Poetic Edda, one of the most important sources for Old Norse myths and legends.
Wonderful. Thank you for joining us today. Joanne, would you like to introduce yourself and your wonderful works?
Hi there, I'm Joanne Harris, and I've been passionate about Norse myths since I was about six or seven, and I've been collecting various versions, translations, retellings ever since. I started to write my own when I was about eight, and I finally got around to getting one of them published much, much later than that, with the Gospel of Loki and Rune Marks, Rune Light, and the Testament of Loki, which are all kind of part of an emerging series which runs lightly over the graves of a lot of serious Norse retellings. But yeah, I'm really happy to be here and to be able to talk about this show, which I might have missed otherwise.
Thank you. I'm very happy to have you with us, and I'm so happy I kind of pestered you into watching it. Okay, Louis, would you like to introduce yourself and your wonderful works?
Yes, hello. I'm Louis Stoll. I'm an author of children's books and now an illustrator too. Mm-hmm. I came to Norse myths through Wagner and Tolkien as a child because I played the trumpet, and it's very rare for orchestral music or operas to have a really good trumpet part. So I was team Wagner because of that, obviously not team the man. We did a performance of the Ring Cycle, like semi-staged. I say the Ring Cycle, I mean a very short section of the Ring Cycle. And it just had a very profound impact on me, these kind of epic stories. And I don't think I really kind of followed them up into the Norse versions until a bit later. But Tolkien also brought me to Norse myths, and in ways that I didn't realise. And I didn't realise all the dwarves from Norse myths. I didn't realise that the ring was, in some ways, the Ring of Anbari. So, yes, I think I only kind of it all bubbled to consciousness later. I had to do a... I had the pleasure of doing a non-fiction book of retelling of the myths, and then that's when I finally actually read the, say, original sources, but the source material, including Caroline's translation of the Poetic Edda and a few others, which eventually led me to write Loki, A Bad God's Guide to Being Good, which you can see arrayed here. This is a child's version of it. It's really cool, so I'm keeping it. So that's a kind of very light-hearted Norse retelling is the wrong word. It's using characters from Norse myths and elements from Norse myths to tell a story about what it means to be a child now, and among other things, what it means to have a family, what gender is, all those things.
Wonderful. We're so glad you could join us for this wonderful panel. Caitlin, would you like to introduce yourself, please?
Hi, I'm Caitlin Felix, and it's really a privilege to be among all of these illustrious authors. I am I'm an author of Norse historical fiction and fantasy, although I don't have a full-length novel out yet. That will be forthcoming in the fall, titled Rand's Daughters. it will be out with Outland Entertainment, but it is a follow-on to my short story with the All Thingy anthology from the same publisher, which dealt with a lot of the history between the Norse peoples and the Muslim peoples, the Arabic peoples, and the trade and the all of the trade routes and all of the interactions between them. I also came to Norse myth and Norse history through Tolkien. I was a very, very big Tolkien fan. You can probably tell by some of the background. Yes, I'm just happy to be here, and it's good to be among you all. Thank you for having me.
You're very welcome, Caitlin. Thank you so much for accepting this invitation for one of my crazy projects. And last but no means least, Genevieve, please introduce yourself.
Hi, I'm Genevieve Gornicek. I ended up like this because I took a course on the Old Norse language when I was at university. And that was my rabbit hole into this entire subject. That autumn, I took a course on the Old Nordic myths, and while I was supposed to be working on my term paper, I wrote this little Loki fan fiction called The Witch's Heart, and many years later ended up as my debut novel in 2021. It is a reimagining of the Norse myths, centering the giantess Angerboda, who we don't know a whole lot about, so I kind of tried to fill in the gaps and write my own little alternate universe kind of story. And then 2 years later, this past summer, my second novel, The Weaver and the Witch Queen, which is a reimagining of the origin story of Gunhild, Mother of Kings, came out. So I really enjoyed, watching Ragnarok, just I guess a little segue into the show. But I'm really happy to be here. So thank you so much for having me.
You're very welcome. I'm so delighted to have all of you again. I mean, I've previously collaborated on my humble videos with Caroline and Joanne before, but equally to spread out and get more of my favourite authors. Admittedly, I've still yet to read your Genevieve, and I will definitely read yours, Caitlin, when it comes out. My shelf is always full of books to read. I keep having to take books off to push on a lovely display like this, because it's usually just full. But I'm so delighted to have you all on board, and of course have more fans to talk about Ragnarok, because no one I know, certainly in my family, in my very small mum friend network, and certainly at work, has not yet seen Ragnarok or even heard of it. And I can't yet quite remember how I came across it. I don't know whether it was just the algorithm, whether it just popped up on an advert, but I started watching it, and then I just carried on. And remarkably, thankfully, 3 seasons later, here I am talking about it. So, Ragnarok, as I mentioned at the start, is set in a fictional town of Edda in Norway. There is a cast of young characters. They're all young people, kind of like sixth form, college, high school kind of age. There's a few adults as well, and it really does explore kind of like family dynamics, identity, belonging, finding oneself, independence. I know I've read articles online that the writer and director say it's really is kind of like almost like a coming of age story, kind of like finding oneself. And season 3 certainly does kind of like clarify that off at the end. We'll get to that bit, because season 3's ending is a hot topic of debate amongst those online that know. But we'll start off, we'll just go with like kind of like the main character, the main protagonist, who comes along and is Magni. He's quite a large, tall, well-built young man. I think it was either ADHD or autism that they mentioned in the first few episodes where they kind of like introduced him to the school. I know he's got some kind of neurodiversity element to it.
Dyslexia.
He was dyslexic.
Dyslexic, that was it. Sorry. It's been a while since I've seen season 1, viewers. I have rewatched all 3 seasons, but it's a lot of episodes. Well, 6 episodes to a season, so you can watch them comfortably within a month, I'd say. Although with me, it was like 1 episode each night, sometimes 2, sometimes 3, sometimes 4 if I wanted to really push the boat out. And he gets approached by an elderly woman of the town called Edda, and she mysteriously awakens some kind of supernatural ability, strength, certainly, when he learns he can throw as a hammer several thousand feet. far away, breaking all world records kind of thing. And he basically becomes, over the story of the three seasons, Thor, which is quite apt because I'm sure Thor's actual sons, didn't in the mythology, Thor's sons have a Magni or a Magnus.
Yes, Magni. Yeah, he has two sons, Modi and Magni.
Magni, there we go. So that's a nice touch that the writers put in there, kind of flagging it up that this guy will become Thor, just for those in the know that know. His story arc over all three seasons, I would describe season one as almost like his Peter Parker coming of becoming a hero kind of thing, because he doesn't, well, he doesn't quite lose his Uncle Ben, but he certainly does lose someone he gets quite attached to in a friendship way, not in a kind of like platonic way, quite early on. We won't give too many names, so I try not to spoil it for dear viewers who will hopefully go and watch this. Please do, please do. afterwards. Does anyone else have any thoughts on Magni's story arc or particular episodes?
I was just thinking about your Peter Parker parallel, and it's that he's bitten by a radioactive auntie in this case.
Not quite bitten. I don't know if she's touched. She's just going to put him on the cheek, doesn't she?
Caressed by a radioactive auntie.
I think one of the interesting things at that point is the way that you begin to see these characters who just like look like ordinary inhabitants of a Norwegian town beginning to emerge. And you see the one-eyed man in his wheelchair, Votan, very early on. And you think, oh, it's just a one-eyed guy in a wheelchair. But when Venka, the character at the supermarket, who turns out to be the seeress, starts to speak to him, it's one of those moments where you go, okay, now I begin to see. And in particular, I think the way that over the episodes, Magni gathers this kind of group of friends. It's classic quest stuff, isn't it? It's like the Companions of the Ring. He gathers his cohort and then he alienates them and then they come back together again. And I think it's really clever the way you begin to see them emerging and go, oh, I see who that is now.
Yeah, you are playing kind of spot the analog all the way through. And sometimes I changed my mind about who people were supposed to represent as I was watching. Because at first I think I didn't read the blurb on Netflix closely enough, and I assumed it was supposed to be Thor's son, not Thor. Because the name, I just was being quite literal, you know.
That would certainly be an interesting take.
Yeah, yeah. Because I don't know if anyone's read The Wicked and the Divine, but this, it was strongly reminding me of that, where, again, you're kind of trying to map your concept of pre-existing gods onto the versions in the story, which, again, is adolescence. And I feel there's something about kind of the change you go through when you're a teenager that really kind of feels a bit like you're coming into your power as a god, but also it's terrifying power. And you know, and you can lose that power quite easily.
Yeah, I thought that really struck me. I thought of The Wicked and the Divine as well. And I also thought of the general idea of God aspects being potentially interchangeable. So, you know, he's named after Thor's son, which, I mean, he could quite easily have been named Thor, so why wasn't he? So I just assumed that this was about trying on personas and different aspects, and that this would be a show about narratives primarily, given that the town is called Edda.
Yeah.
And also what struck me was the idea that disability marks special ability, and it's a question of looking beyond it. So, you know, there's a reason that Wotan is in a mobility scooter and that Magni has these Coke bottle glasses that he quickly gets rid of when he starts coming into his new identity.
I like the idea of it being a kind of loose set of connections to the myths. And partly because I think the experience of myth is that it's not a kind of, it's not a system, you know, it's not a kind of organized religion. It is, you know, each figure in the myths can be interpreted in different ways, and in different texts they'll turn up as different people. So I think actually my instinct was to try and look for very strict connections, but actually I think that was wrong, and I think it is more fluid. And as you say, Joanne, it's the idea of trying on identities that is key, you know, for that kind of particular age.
It is. And also when and the fact that they're coming from a different place into a new school is interesting, because that's what you do when you go to a new school, isn't it? You try on a new you and you make new friends in a different way. And there is this general feeling that this is also what they're doing. And that this sense of place is absolutely attached to this new identity that they've got.
And it's classic teen TV. It's the opening of Buffy as well, where she comes to a new school.
Oh, yeah.
It's archetypal. Oh, pardon me.
Sorry.
Oh, I was just going to say, like, it's very much like archetypes held very, very loosely. We don't really see a lot of who they were, Magni or Lauritz, before they come to Edda to have a new beginning. So it is very much tying in with that, like these archetypes that we have in Norse mythology, and coming into yourself as a person, as an adult, a young adult. I found that very, very interesting. Particularly because when I was about the same age, I moved away from America to Europe and reinvented myself in an entirely different way. So I connected very, very strongly with that.
And I thought that, without saying anything in too much detail about the ending, when we get to that much discussed ending, we have to remind ourselves, I think, this was always a high school story in a way. And that may not exactly explain away the ending, but it does give you a way of accounting for it that makes some kind of narrative sense, I would say. Though the more I've been thinking about the ending, the more questions it's been raising for me over the last few weeks thinking about it.
Interesting.
Absolutely.
And I think it's interesting too that like Magne and Lauritz like were kind of on a parallel path of like reinventing themselves, right? Because Lauritz's character arc, like the way that he changes during the show, like, oh, it's so beautiful.
I would die for Lauritz. I love Lauritz.
Oh my god, like the end of season one where he's impersonating Ron. Oh, so beautiful.
Iconic.
Truly.
For viewers who have yet to learn about the wonderful series, Lauritz and Magni are brothers, presented as brothers at the start of the film, and they're moving back to Edda because their mum needs a new job, and that's where she's going to get a new job. But it turns out that she actually grew up there and met their father there and did start initially with the family there, but then their father died. We don't know why or how. Or exactly precisely when, although I do know they visited the gravestone and I can't remember what date was on his gravestone. I think it was 2002. But then they left and now they're coming back. So it's a strange return story for the mother as well as the sons.
But they need that return for the history, don't they?
Yes,
so that when
they do.
Lauritz discovers who his real father is, and that all has to be explained from that episode in the past that the boys can't remember.
I love their mother. She is one of my favorite characters.
She's so much like my mum. It's scary sometimes.
I feel like she's like one of the most relatable mothers of a chosen one that I've encountered in fiction. And also the supporting cast, not just the side characters, but like the other kids.
Yes,
oh my, like Magne, the guy who's running around shouting all the time. Like what must a chosen one look like from the outside for people who have no idea what's going on? That was a really nice touch.
Well, as we said, Lauritz is Magni's brother, and if Magni is indeed becoming in many various ways Thor, Lauritz definitely, totally, and very clearly becomes the Loki character. And I must admit, he does a better job than Tom Hiddleston in some ways, mainly because Tom Hiddleston's character is very much nailed down in Marvel law, so to speak, whereas this one it feels very organic, very real, and again reflects so much of what teenagers and young people go through, especially not just kind of like in terms of family dynamics. As Caroline's explained, Lauritz discovered that he's not actually the full brother to Magni, he's a half brother. Turid, their mother, had a slight fling with a part of the cast we haven't yet actually mentioned, which is the Jutul family. And for those who are slightly familiar with Old Norse, and I'm only slightly familiar, I do know that Jutul at least alludes to giant. And of course, Thor and giants, they never get along in classic mythology. And they're very much part of the whole Ragnarok setup, aren't they, really? So it turns out that, of course, Laerts is the secret son of what ultimately becomes Magni's great antagonist, which is Vidar, which is the head of the Jotul family. The Jotul family are very much kind of like very social elite. They run and own the big chemical factory, which makes a lot of work and wealth for the town of Edda. There's a very strong environmental theme all the way through, which I think is also relatable because, of course, I know, like, I'm sure kind of like an environmental crisis or environmental anxiety was like one of the key words in the English dictionary several years ago, because it's just been getting prevalent and more prevalent in young people's minds, especially with Greta Thunberg, who I know, Saxa, who is the daughter of Vidar Jotul, actually kind of like quotes back up Gree, quite aptly in one of her kind of like sassier moments. The Jotul family has Vidar, there is Ran, his wife, who is also a giantess, and they have two giantess children, although they're not Rans, which is rather interesting, Fjord and Saxa. And I do think, as the viewers will then learn, kind of like they're basically immortals. They can age themselves very elderly, or they can kind of remain very mature, very professional age kind of thing, more middle age. And of course, when there's scenes of Vidar looking through the old family photo album, and there's like really, really old ones that you wouldn't see from like the 18th century kind of thing, I keep thinking, do they each take it in turns being the adults in this family? Because the family resemblance of the
same question
of actors is remarkable. They do look remarkably like each other. And I thought they've done rather well to get these cast of actors together really well.
I think they do discuss that in one scene when Vidar and Ran are being very kind of paternal, almost, you know, parent-like, and bossing the kids around. The kids are saying, well, yeah, this is your turn to be in charge and tell us what to do. But yeah, next time around, we'll be the parents. And if you look back in the album, you can see how those facial types kind of recur. So it does seem that they take it in turns generationally. And I guess they have to pretend to die.
This makes a lot of sense, because this is one of the themes, isn't it, of the piece. It is all about cycles and the beginnings and the ends of cycles. They kind of inhabit the cycle there, and it is to them it is a cycle of power and reincarnation. But it's interesting that they are the giants in mythology, but they're also the giants in terms of industry and wealth. And they are kind of labelled almost instantly as the, you know, the adversary, because they are doing harm both to the land and to specific individuals. And you know that basically their wealth and their power is going to be something that the heroes of this story are going to have to challenge and potentially overcome in some way or another. And you know that the fact that they've entered this kind of Eddic narrative means that they too have a role to play in this cycle, and you can kind of see it coming from very, very early on.
I wondered if anybody had thoughts on the fact that the giants are the ones destroying the environment, versus like in the myths, how they kind of like represent nature and have all these associations with nature.
I was seeing that in connection with the Ragnarok myth. So the idea that the giants are the ones that bring about the end of the world, and the Jotul family are in this context bringing about the end of the literal world. But I do, it is interesting that starts off as a literal version of the end of the world, our world, but then with, what spoilers am I allowed to say? In terms of a slightly more metaphorical destruction.
It is interesting. I never thought of that, Genevieve. That's a really good, because kind of like we know kind of like there's the fire giants in Muspelheim, I don't know. I want to say ice giants, but I don't think there is ice giants canonically in the Norse.
Totally ice. Yeah. Well, they're totally frost giants, obviously. Yeah, so. Totally, but also, they're in charge of a balance, aren't they? They're holding a balance, and it is the unbalance that happens that brings about Ragnarok. And the gods are at the heart of it, actually. The gods are basically what unbalances this kind of cosmic oneness,
which is kind of like
brings out this conflict.
It's like the The creation myth, actually, is the appearance of the gods is what causes the conflict with the giants by killing them.
Yes.
It's making the world from you, mate.
And I'm pretty sure that in dialogue terms, there's a point, again, where the kind of family history of the Yertles is being discussed, that maybe Ran, it is, says, well, in the old days, we used to be content with owning the sheep and having a kind of pastoral agrarian economy, but we had to move with the times. And we had to, when Norway industrialized, we had to industrialize as well, because that's how we had to keep our power. And maybe there's a sense there that it's, if that entails environmental destruction, that goes with industrialization. And they don't care, because they should care, really, because if they're immortal, they're going to have to live with the consequences longer than the human population of Edda.
Maybe they do have another realm.
It's as if powers become more important for them than the kind of role that Genevieve was talking about being kind of guardians of nature. And they become modern. And that kind of dialogue about, will Saxa have a role in the firm? And she gets excluded, and then she wants to come back with a real green new environmentalist policy. You can see how she kind of shifts from the old style capitalist model that the Yertles had into this newer form of social enterprise.
And there's a really strong industrial political allegory running through the whole of this about times changing, cycles repeating themselves but being broken by change, and how to adapt and how to survive rather than be broken by what goes on. And I think, you know, but it's this kind of starts to hint at itself very early on, and this is why I think the Yertles have these conversations, these earnest discussions about whether they have sold out from the old ways, whether they have to change, or whether they actually should change back. And there's this constant feeling within the family that there are breakaway youth factions that are getting far too interested in what people are wearing at school and who's going out with who, whereas in fact they should be looking at ruling the world, which is their job. And I just love the fact that it keeps shuttling back and forth from these two poles.
That's a very good point.
That's a really good point, because Saxa is the one saying, like, you're having emotions. Why are you having emotions? Like, this whole, like, I love that. That's a good point.
You sit and watch cartoons whilst kind of like eating popcorn all day, what you said to Vida. And of course, kind of like Saxa getting onto the white wine once Laurit enters the family.
That is one of the most beautiful moments. Like, Vida is just on the couch eating candy.
Yeah, watching some kind of American drama.
I'm making brownies.
I find like it's so
it really is interesting, like old guard versus new guard coming through.
It gets kind of your too, like the Vidar. Ran tells Vidar, like, you're not good at emotions, and within the same episode, at the very end, during the protest in front of the Yertle Industries factory. Somebody's asking Vidar for a statement, you know, what are you going to say about this protest? And he says, well, I'm not good at emotions. But earlier in that same episode, like, you can see the emotion on his face. You can see the tears in his eyes. Not spoiling too much here, but it was, to me, that was a really interesting parallel, how so many times one of these characters, one of these Yertles, are telling off someone else, or saying, hey, no, you can't do it that way, or why are you being this way? But then that very same character goes and does the same thing. Yeah. It's really interesting. Back to the cycles thing we were saying before.
It's interesting because...
That's a really good observation. I think it's... Sorry, Lou. I think it's really interesting that when you look at these factions of people, it's almost as if all of them inhabit some kind of area of neurodiversity, and the Yertles inhabit this disconnection with feeling, whereas the gods are all about the feelings, and sometimes there's a bit less thought going on. And so the idea that actually the reason they're drawn together so much, that the reason that they're drawn to each other even though they're adversaries, is that actually they belong together. They should be completing themselves rather than tearing themselves apart. And there's this hint of, this is why they're always kind of hanging around each other and observing each other and fancying the pants off each other.
I love that.
Yeah, I mean, in the Yuttle family, when they have disagreements, they either beat each other up or wield out knives and try to kind of like ninja attack each other. It's very much kind of like they go kind of like down the aggressive kind of like physical domination route, where of course with Magni and Lauritz's family, I mean, I'll always remember when there was a scene, I think, where Lauritz tells to kind of like, you've never taken responsibility for anything, and oh, by the way, you're out of milk kind of thing. I think that was in season two, and she takes it on so emotionally negatively that she goes to the shop and she's just endlessly putting on snacks in front of Wench at the shop, just kind of like buying more and more sweets. Mm. And she kind of like has then a go at Wench because she's just angry at the world, and she just takes herself off to the sofa and kind of like stuffs herself full of chocolate and falls asleep there. And now it's like, well, Magni, look what you've done to your mum because you keep getting into trouble at school and you keep doing all this kind of thing. Mm. And really it's Lauritz's fault that his mum's feeling that way, because he put it really quite forcefully down. Mm. But in terms of emotions with Yuttle, Saxa definitely is the one that seems to be able to use them for her own gain, whereas Fjord is trying to explore emotions on a mortal level, because of course he gets involved with the other teenager, Gree, which especially kind of like during season one, I thought that was a really interesting kind of switch. Because kind of like we're seeing Magni trying to kind of like get into the Yuttle family or go against them, and then at the same time he's got a friend who's allying with them out of their own relationship and their own emotion. He's got to kind of like deal with that, and I think he does deal with it to a degree quite well. Although of course in season one, the big thing that struck out for me is how when they find that Magni is getting a problem, that they realise he is taking on the powers of Thor, and he keeps kind of like, he knows of the old world, as they kind of like taunt him with during a really bizarre hiking trip up a mountain where Fjord's butchering something very meaty looking. Kind of like it's Fjord, not Vida. She says, well, why do we let the system deal with him? He's going to get psychoanalyzed. He's going to have to go to treatment and therapy and be socially excluded. That's a lot worse than what we could physically do to him with your axe, Dad, kind of thing. I thought, yeah, because in modern society, it is very much psychological suffering more than physical suffering and combat and injury that we suffer from. Like, and of course, the Yuttles kind of like are a mix of that themselves.
Yeah. Speaking of a mix, making the point about the idea that the kind of giants are the ones that have problems accessing emotion and the gods ones almost too much emotion, and thinking about Lauritz in the middle of that. And sometimes you do see him in this very strategic use of emotion for manipulation. But then when he's actually full of need, that goes out the window and he's not very strategic, you know, and he does just kind of need things. So whether it's Jens, the boyfriend, or family from his blood family, and I feel like in that kind of the mercurial nature of the character, that sort of fits as he's stretched between the worlds of the giants and the world of the gods, but also between emotion and strategy, which obviously he's my favorite character.
Goes without saying, he's everybody's favorite character.
Yeah,
but he's also this character of contradictions, isn't he? He's constantly contradicting who he is, either through gender or through his relationships or through, you know, what he wants. Most of what he wants, he has no idea what he wants, but he does know that people are stopping him from getting it somehow and that it's somebody else's fault.
I was thinking about his child, the teenage pregnancy.
Oh, yes, we need to get that.
The tapeworm.
We have to speak monsters at some point. Sorry.
That it's changed from Sleipnir in the myths to the world serpent. Mm-hmm. And I was wondering why that was. And I'm wondering if it was just as simple as like a horse with eight legs is quite silly, whereas a massive serpent thing is very disturbing to give birth to. Mm-hmm. But it was interesting. It's two versions.
So it's kind of constantly present and you can't see it. Whereas if you had Sleipnir, you are galloping through the people go, whoa, that's weird. But this lurking menace, I think, is really good.
And I suppose it goes with that idea of the water being poisoned as well, and kind of poisoned by a monster as well as by the heavy metals or whatever the pollution was.
Mm. What I was thinking about...
It's a nice reflection of how...
The rubber ups, isn't it?
No, it's all right. You go first, Joanne.
Sorry,
you're slightly breaking up for me. I don't know if that's...
Now I can't quite hear.
Another physical
If you keep talking, Joanne, it'll come round, don't worry.
Yeah, it's probably me. I was just saying that it fills the of the cycle of rebirth, and you know, it's the Ouroboros, it's the snake with its tail in its mouth, which is actually the visual representation of this story and where this story is going. Does that make sense? I might have been kind of garbled before.
Well, I think that makes sense. Makes sense. World Serpent has a Ouroboros because it encircles the world, and but I guess it also that brings an image of self-destruction to a degree as well.
Yeah.
That actually all these characters are very self-destructive. And I feel like that speaks to the teen drama element as well, because obviously so much of teenage life is creating problems for yourself that you didn't have to begin with.
It's actually quite an interesting folkloric motif, isn't it? That quite often you get a little serpent-y thing, and you, in some myths, you put a piece of gold underneath it every day and it grows bigger and bigger until it's eating two oxen a week and it's a real problem.
Yeah.
Or you, as in the story of the Lambton worm, you catch this tiny thing and you throw it in a well and it gets bigger and bigger. Mm-hmm. And the idea that, I mean, Lawrence's tapeworm is disgusting enough when he's keeping it in his bedroom, but the idea that... Yeah. Once it's out in nature, plus, as you were saying, the heavy metal elements that are causing this kind of really unnatural growth, I think is one of the ways that the environmental storyline and the mythic storyline and the kind of weird teenage psyche storylines all come together very nicely at that point. It was a real moment when I went, yes, yes.
And the growth element parallels another one of Loki's children. So you have Fenris Wolf kind of getting bigger and bigger until it's too big for Asgard. And I like it. They have kind of combined all three children in one in different aspects of the story.
Yeah, and it's all quite connects to Loki, how he's kind of like, he has these connections to all these destructive forces.
Mm.
I mean, without Loki going off with Angerboda, those children would have been there. So it's kind of... He has a lot of connection to what ultimately topples the gods and everything with them.
Mm.
And I think I've got on my note from episode 3 in season 2, Lauritz asked the teacher, who is quite a common character and he has quite a mainstay. I quite like him, although I did get sad when he lost his beard.
But that's just me too. Beard.
He asked the teacher, kind of like, he literally says, does Loki giving birth to the world serpent, and asks that, does that make him, in fact, the first transgender figure in mythology? Which I thought, it's like, yeah, that's a big kind of like EDI flag right there. And it kind of makes so much sense. Although it's interesting that in this particular world of Eda, that's what they're being taught, that Loki gave birth to the world serpent. So they have definitely adapted literally within the education to make what then happens fit.
That is a theory.
Well, anyway. But I was thinking about his, I mean, the show tends to use male pronouns for Lawrence throughout, I think, unless they change.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I feel like the kind of actual interior gender identity of Lawrence is never fully spelled out. It's more kind of question of various gender expressions from Lawrence, and you never find out really who Lawrence is for them themselves, you know.
And I think that is so appropriate, especially like Lord's calling himself mommy, like when he's talking to the serpent.
I also wanted to, like, I really found it interesting how Lauritz really is so dedicated to the serpent in season 3.
It was very
particularly moving. Yeah, like, so we see Lauritz as kind of like an angry character. Like, he kind of comes into the story very, very angry, you know, typical, you know, moody teenager. Mm-hmm. And he always has this feeling of being an outsider. And throughout, you know, season 1 and season 2, we see him be rejected quite often. And so when he finds that Vidar is his real father, he really embraces that. Mm-hmm. And from Magni's perspective, it can be quite, from the outside, it looks quite manipulative in some ways. And it causes a few problems, and in the end, like, Vidar does reject him, but then he accepts him again, and it goes through this cycle. And so when season 3 comes around, and I feel like Lauritz has come into himself more as a person and as his queer identity, he very much shows the serpent full acceptance. He's afraid of it, but he keeps showing up for the serpent. And he brings him food, and he's constantly like nurturing the serpent and calling himself mommy. And I just found that such a nice, like, parallel or a mirror to how he feels in the first season, where he feels like nobody really wants him. He's treated differently. People see him differently. He calls himself a freak at one point, and it's only his own mother who tells him, "You're not a freak, but there might be a reason you feel different."
And I love in season one how he is just kind of almost like in the background for a lot of it, right? He's like hanging out with these people, hanging out with those people, never like quite fitting in, but like when he is useful to them, he is accepted and embraced. Yeah. And that is like so Loki. Like,
I love what they did with that. Moments of fitting in are kind of almost against people's will. So when he joins the Giants Dance, which I think is one of my favorite scenes in the entire
movie. Absolutely.
He's not invited, you know what I mean? He just feels it. And he claims that identity in quite an aggressive way.
I really found that interesting. They don't push him away. They let him dance with them.
But it isn't kind of like, come on now, join us. It's more, oh, you're here. We can't deny you, you know.
They recognize something, don't they, though? That's the thing. Yeah. And I think the interesting thing about the way Laritz develops is that he's developing alongside the serpent inside him, basically. I mean, there's a whole of this throughout the whole of season one. There is this standing joke that he's always eating what's wrong with him. He's always eating snacks, and then you realize that he's eating snacks because he has a tapeworm, and the tapeworm is going to become the Midgard serpent, which is hilarious enough as a story arc. But there is also, I mean, if we put my psychological hat on, there is this idea that Larry has a hunger for something and he doesn't know what it is. This hunger externalizes as the serpent, and then he feeds it. So is it a hunger for affection? Is it a hunger for being accepted? Is it for something else, for power over other people? And eventually he lets it go, which psychologically is very pleasing. And in terms of the arc of that character is delightful, because you can see that it has paralleled his uncomfortable adolescent phase and followed him into adulthood, where he can let this go and properly start being himself, having gone through a number of identities and ended up as mother, and then ended up as, well, basically free from both sides, which is absolutely, you know, what we would hope for that character, who is a delightful character in every way.
Because Magni does introduce him to Wotan when Wotan finally gets his awakening after the CRS, unfortunately, he is killed off. And thinking back to kind of like your introduction and Louise regarding Lord of the Rings, it suddenly made me had a mirror image of how kind of like Bilbo and the, not Bilbo, the Hobbits? No.
Frodo,
sorry. It's been a while since I've seen the films, let alone read the books. Frodo and the Hobbits and kind of like the Ranger and the Elves kind of like escaping the Balrog, and they kind of like lose Gandalf, because Gandalf is effectively their CRS. He's shepherding them to do great things. But the CRS and Gandalf are both claimed unexpectedly and taken away out of the picture. And so the heroes are left to try and work things out for themselves, which I think was rather apt.
But also Odin, Wotan's rejection of Loritz is really interesting, because, I mean, in the mythology, they're blood brothers, in a kind of mythical past that we never really find out why. But actually, increasingly, as the story goes, the stories go on, they're alienated, and obviously eventually Odin sends him to punishment. So I guess we kind of start from that point of view in Edda. Like, we're already at the kind of, it's very nearly the end of the world. Odin has rejected Loki. This isn't a good thing, you know.
Well, the word betrayal keeps coming up so many times when I'm looking over the notes that Becky made to season three in particular, but also the summaries for season two. Lauritz says Magna has betrayed him. Magna says Lauritz has. The Yordles say he's betraying them. No, they're betraying him, and so on. And Joanna, I think, is absolutely right to celebrate the way that he finds his place in by the end. And as both he and Magna step into their adult identities, and Magna throws away his comic books, you can see how when fans online say, will there be a Ragnarok season four? You go, oh, have you understood nothing here? No, it can't happen.
Well, it could happen to a bunch of other kids, I guess. Like, the cycle starts again. In Iceland.
There's certainly a strong set of episodes that have the strong kind of like father and son theme going on. Because, of course, Vidar and Lauritz, getting along and kind of like Magni trying to work out his new brother relationship. But then, of course, Fjord and his relationship to his family, and of course, with Vida. There's Gree and her father, because of course, that seems to be mixed, because Gree's father is terminally poorly because of the work he did for Fjord's father in the factory. That kind of there's a straight dynamic there. But then there's a fortunate series of deaths, because Magni does end up killing Vida, not in quite the climactic way that you would have thought. It almost happens accidentally, so to speak. But that was because Magni was trying to protect Laritz. Gree's father sadly commits suicide because he decides it's just the best way to go. And so both Gree and Fjord both lose their father. And then the whole complex Magni then feels upon having claimed a life in this battle, having taken that first step. He's been speaking about battle for ages. He gets Mjolnir made, because of course he does not always do this alone, Divius. He does actually get some allies. The CRS does unite him with one other goddess, which is Freya in the form of Iman, who is a teenager of Sri Lankan heritage. She was adopted but raised in Norway. So it's another kind of like outsider, but a nice cultural mix of, well, anyone with godly powers can come from anywhere, which is kind of nice. And she's got very strong suggestive powers, very strong death. I love how she's like, oh, I got these clothes for free. I got my dentist treatment for free. I got on the bus for free. I just have to blink and everyone's for free. And Mike's like, no, you do not use your powers to get things for free. We're in a war here. We've got to fight the giants. And she's like, well, I guess. She's kind of like very carefree about her. She doesn't have the social complexities or responsibility that Magni, for some reason, very strongly feels. I guess, especially with the Laritz connection.
Well, I suppose in terms of the goddess Freya, she's other to the Asgardians in some ways, you know, being...
Yes, she is. She's Vanir, isn't she?
And, but I do, I mean, sometimes, every now and then in the show, I do think a little bit of misogyny creeps in, because I do feel like the way they've portrayed Freya is quite like, aren't women manipulative, you know, rather than isn't she just enjoying the sex, you know, it's quite there's something about it. And I think obviously there's some elements of like they're contrasting with the old world and the new, and the idea of the giant's sexism is kind of displayed as bad, but I feel like it's also contemporary sexism in terms of, you know, the way that the myths are interpreted, and some interesting stuff like the fact that they make Laritz gay, as far as I can tell, rather than bisexual. And obviously in the myths Loki is attracted to women too, and then the fact that they do a bit of a fridging of a gay to begin the story, and I don't know what to make of that, really. It's just it's all those different elements of kind of modern and ancient and kind of contemporary values, and I don't know how much is expressing the kind of values of Norwegian society in the present day, because I'm not very familiar with it. But because it does feel like the Jutuls and the fact that they're a very kind of local family is quite interesting. It's not a kind of Elon Musk situation. It's not a billionaire from elsewhere. It's a homegrown wealthy person. So it's a bit more feudal. And I don't know if that's more common in Norway, you know.
I think there is a really interesting counterpoint there between the tradition, which in Norway is patriarchal and quite conservative, with the new and the liberal, which in Norway is also very strong. And so that I think, as in a lot of Germanic countries, there is this dual nature, which is sometimes in opposition, partly because the tradition has been so monolithic for such a long time. And I think you're right, it does reflect some of that, which to me is really interesting, because it's not just about the generations, it's also about the community and how the community perceives itself and why the community agrees to be ruled in effect by this powerful old family. And there is a sort of sense of thus it has always been from people who might possibly know better but who obviously don't. And so there's this idea that these youngsters are pushing all the boundaries and they're not always getting it right, but something needs to give.
But they don't want to leave, do they? And I think it's very much sort of emblematic of isolated Norwegian field communities where there's only one industry in town and you have to work in that industry. We recognize it from our own kind of post-industrialization. Either you work in the supermarket like Turid, the mother, or like Venka, or Turid manages to get a job in admin back in the company, but the company is the only game in town, and if you don't want to be part of that, then you have to leave. And it's very much the kind of story that you find in a number of Scandinavian things. I've just been watching The State of Happiness, Lykkeland, which is all about the oil industry in Stavanger. And oil, you can't do, you can try and do the fishing at the same time, but the oil is the only game in town. And the current True Detective, Snow Country, set in Alaska, it's all about the mine. The mine is poison. So this idea of industrialization, which brings wealth but also poisons the environment, and you have to live with it, you can't undo it because it will destroy the community. It's a really powerful myth that runs through these stories with a kind of mythic supernatural base, I think.
It's interesting that they've actually matched it with the school stuff, because in season one, Gree and Magni originally teamed up with Isolde before she sadly dies and is the catalyst for a lot of things, have to write a paper on life in Edda, and that's kind of like, he gets inspired by his old kind of like very rebellious protesting kind of like, I'm against the whole power structure of society kind of thing. She wants to topple them over, and he tries to camp in that, but he does get pushed down by systems in kind of like even like, because Ram, wife of the company owner, is headmistress of the school, so she's also in a powerful position. She can say, no, we allow free speech, but what you're actually doing is just a bit worrying, concerning, and then they're given loads of psychiatric labels and having to see a counsellor, and they basically use the system to push his protests down. And of course, in season two, they've now got to write a report on Norse myths told to put myths in a modern context, quote. They were the actual words. I thought, are you literally mettering your kind of like yourself this series?
I just thinking about that, and how it's not just about putting the myths in a modern context, it's also a local context. So you have that idea of the giants are bringing about the end of the world, which could mean climate change in the macro scale, but it's also local pollution. And that idea of, you know, kind of the personal and the general kind of combined. As I do with almost anything, I bring it back to Buffy. Thinking about how there's a line about, you know, every teenage girl feels like it's the end of the world if they can't go to a party. And obviously in Buffy, it literally is the end of the world. And how those kind of overwrought teenage emotions are both about kind of high school in general, but also specifically that, you know, Norwegian teenage experience of small town. I really like the point you were making, Caroline, about the fact that these communities exist like this and they do have these issues. It was reminding me of Kate Beaton's graphic novel Ducks, well, graphic memoir, which is set in Canada, which is about kind of that idea of the only game in town, the oil field that that destroys but also is the only option for making money. So yes, there's kind of, because there's never really a suggestion that the people will rise up and overthrow the Jutuls, at least at the start, you know, like it takes the gods to light that, you know, light that touch paper.
And even then, a little bit of the small townness creeps in after Vidar dies and people start to be more sympathetic toward the Jutuls. Like, even when, you know, the boss at Edda Grillin, like, is giving Fjordri stuff, and Magnus like, what is happening? Because, I mean, like, they obviously aren't lacking for money. They could pay, but they're just giving them free stuff.
Yeah,
you know, you think Magni tries to correct that
by kind of like carrying his hammer, because he does. Oh, the hammer is another interesting one.
His arrogant arc, let's say.
Yes. This is Thor portrayed in a way that many people would never imagine Thor being portrayed, and I quite like how. To recap for dear viewers, he and Iman, aka Freyja, manipulate a local mechanic into making what he imagines Mjolnir to be, having studied various videos and images on Google and his laptop. And of course, he suddenly learns that when he throws it, nothing happens. He throws it very far because he's got very strong arms. His muscles just keep getting bigger and bigger. I don't know how he does it. Quite literally, as an actor, he just must have been gymming the whole acting series. But it doesn't come back. And that's near when, unfortunately, they lose the Seer Ass, when she goes, oh, it's the most powerful weapon in the world. You can't just make it. There's an old fire. You need to do this. But that's as much as he learns. And yet somehow he does work out that the old fire is deep underground under the actual chemical factory site itself, and him and Wotan and a person with dwarfism from the care home where Wotan is resides, and I think Iman, oh no, definitely the mechanic and Iman as well, they all infiltrate and break in under the guise of environmental protest, which I thought was rather clever, keeping that environment theme going. And the things Magni does with the hammer, like putting in a feather so it always flies back to him, putting in an arrow so it always knows who to strike, I thought that's really clever, but where do they get that idea from? I would like to know. Is it original thinking, or is there something deep in the lore somewhere about how Mjolnir was made? Because I don't know.
Something about the effect of the arrow.
Yeah. But I think it's really clever.
I think it's probably borrowing from the complicated forging of the chain
glyphs,
is bound, that you put in these paradoxical and strange elements of sympathetic magic that
make the chain
into something which can't be. It's got the beard of a woman and the roots of the mountains and so on, and that makes it kind of... It doesn't look like a chain, but it is a chain. So I think they've kind of transposed that very cleverly, put in these elements that then give Mjolnir these unseen powers. But yet also kind of from a modern point of view, a technological point of view, if you want to retool Mjolnir, as it were, what things you need it to be able to do, and then you've got your little tick list, and you have to think magically in order to put the right bits in.
I didn't quite like that. But of course, Mjolnir becomes quite a negative force and influence upon Manny. And I know I've got in my notes somewhere that there's like a whole string of influences, kind of, where is it? Not season three. Or is it season three? No, it's season two. Nope, season three. Ah, there it is. Episode three, season three. Saxa influences Magni, bad influence. Fjord influences Jormungand, otherwise known as Little S, bad influence. Set up, and that leads into Thor losing his hammer in a really wonderful, and I hope you'll agree with me, a wonderful adaptation of Thor going fishing for the Jormungand, Gansert, and going fishing with a giant who does not quite abandon him as Fjord does out on the fjord, but he does go fishing with a giant. Am I right in the old lore? But I thought that was rather good. And of course, when he like took out the fishing tackle, I thought, oh my goodness, is he actually going to fish out the world serpent? He didn't quite do it. But it was a very wonderful adaptation. And I thought, oh, they're actually using canonical scenes that I, from my very small, limited reading compared to you lovely ladies, am familiar with. And the other myth that I think that I did slightly adapt, or at least pay homage to, is when they try and get Lauritz to go back to the Jutuls to get the hammer, because, of course, Fjord then takes the hammer. Well, the Jutuls, actually, because they work out what Lauritz is doing, they make Lauritz dress up as Fjord, which is, I thought, oh, that's a kind of twist on how Thor in the mythology has to go to the Thrym's wedding dressed up as the bride. They're making the Loki dress up, not intentionally, but out of like force and necessity, otherwise he'll kind of get it, basically.
So he's dragging as a man?
Well... Yeah, I mean, of course, I know Genevieve mentioned, like, he dressed up as Ram at the end of season one, that does definitely reflect the gender fluidity of Loki and how he can, like, change his shape to become anyone, anything. But at least with Ram, he did that out of his own initiative and own sense of mischief.
Yeah.
With trying to get the hammer, it does kind of reflect how, in the Lay of Thrym, when Thor tries to get the hammer back, he has to dress up for it. So it's not Magni getting dressed up, it's Lauritz. That kind of thing. So I thought that was maybe a nice twist.
It was a lovely twist. I think everything gets slightly revisited in a different way from a different perspective. But I think if we look at Thor's hammer as being his version of Loki's tapeworm, it comes from something unresolved in his personality. So Loki, it's hunger for something that he doesn't know what it is. And with Thor, it's basically rage. And we don't quite know where it comes from. But it sort of keeps arriving from different points. Sometimes it's rage about being inarticulate and not good at school, or rage at not having success with the girl that he wants. And the hammer, when it arrives, becomes an instrument of this. And he goes through a phase of not being able to control it, which is where he goes through his arrogant arc and his ugly manipulative arc and his threatening weird angry arc, and
it's
then finally the hammer becomes something else. It becomes something that he can control again, and in a way that's him coming to terms with that side of his personality.
Well, it reminded me a lot, going back to like Viking Spider-Man, you know, with great power comes great responsibility, and he has to learn that lesson. And it's yet another thing pointing towards, you know, this is, you're on the cusp of manhood. What kind of man are you going to be? You don't need a hammer to be a man, but you're using it as a bludgeon. This is how you exercise that rage and that feeling of pressure and feeling of growing up, but not really knowing what you're doing.
I totally agree. And there's even that scene where he's sitting in his room, like talking to himself, like,
oh yeah,
I need the hammer to control everyone. So this idea that like he needs to have this control is something.
So of course Saxa does come quite to the fore. She has her own kind of like downfall in a way. Interestingly, that when Fjord decides he's done with the Yuttles, they actually allow him to walk out alive. Kind of like he seems to almost stun Vida with the fact that, oh my goodness, Michael has just turned to me and says, no, I'm no longer your son. I'm going to become a mortal and live a happy life. Whereas when Saxa, I can't remember what her actual crime was. I can't remember, but they do punish her by literally making her become a slave. Very much housebound. She doesn't get to
come.
I can't remember. A lot happens in these episodes. Yeah. A lot happens. Like, you can see why they only made them 6 episodes in each series. But they keep her housebound. She gets to do all the manual work. She doesn't lose her job in the company because Fjord comes back. He kind of like remains free to a degree until Vidar dies. And then he gets a big masculine complex of family authority and, okay, right, I must avenge you, father. I will rise to the fore and kill Magni for you. But she actually gets that black collar put on. I thought that made me think of all the collars that you can find in like museums that link to Vikings and slavery. I thought that was a nice little maybe homage to that kind of part of Norse history, and that Vikings were big slave traders. And if the giants are the bad guys, then let's make them owner of slaves, kind of thing.
But I mean, also the idea of being bound in Norse mythology is very powerful. And it's often you are bound because you are powerful, because you're a threat. So she's a threat to the power structure. So like Fenrir's bound, like Loki's bound. You don't bind the weak, do you? You bind the strong. And it's sort of almost a testament to her own power that they do it to her, as well as them being horrible and humiliate her, you know.
Because their attempts to get the hammer don't work. So she goes, well, I could always use my feminine guiles and just kind of like talk to Manny, because he won't kill me straight away. We've kind of reached some kind of informal truce kind of thing, and that we've both got a sibling within both sides of the family now.
Yeah.
And she really enables that relationship he has with the hammer. She kind of like uses and abuses it in very directly. Like, I love how she kind of, oh, I've got you a new bag for your hammer, my darling, here. Make sure you carry it with you at all times, so then I feel strong, and then you can put my family in their place. And they it's like when teenagers first get their own bank account, like, yes, I've got money, I can buy things, and he just goes nuts, doesn't he? He gets on this power rush.
Yeah.
But then that plays beautifully into when he finally gets kind of like that kind of like grown-up talk that he has with Wotan up on the mountainside. And it does get interrupted because Saxa tries to come along and disturb things, but they both won't kind of make the killing blow. She won't launch this, or did she throw the spear? I think she did. But then he's like, oh, I could kill you with a hammer right now, but I'm not. And she just turns and runs, and he doesn't act on it. And Wotan says kind of like, Thor isn't Thor just because of his hammer. He doesn't just destroy things, he creates life. And they have that deep psychological dive into what is driving Magni's character, and it's all about how he feels like he let it all down, how he let his mum down, how he let the woman, the innocent woman that he nearly gets to kind of like, because he does try a diplomatic way of getting rid of the Utals by kind of like uncovering all their secrets, doing proper investigative journalism kind of thing. But of course the Utals kind of get wind and stuff on top of that. But speaking of Wotan, and that, it's always made me chuckle that one scene where him and his associate, who eventually becomes Heimdall, and a rather unfortunate but not quite good watcher of the gods, get arrested for doing narcotics when he's trying to see what Freya's Iman saw, because Iman sees the end coming and she of course Scarpers, and it's really only Iman and the mechanic that actually leave Edda and go and make success elsewhere outside of the old thing. They use their gifts and their powers. The mechanic loses his hand when they try and forge the hammer, so he basically becomes Tyr. Doesn't quite get bitten off by a wolf, but it was a very heavy door, so I'll submit to that. And he becomes a famous Paralympian in Norway, which makes a lot of sense. Promotes the kind of disability community and the athletes that they are. And of course, Iman becomes like, she goes on effectively a Love Island sort of version in this universe and becomes a key influencer and that kind of thing. So she kind of like manipulates any kind of influence to spread her influence. But I really liked how Wotan at first appears to be a really big manipulator himself, in the way he says to Magni that if you want to protect your brother, you have to betray him. We need that key to go and make your hammer so you can then protect everyone, including your brother. So I know your brother told you not to harm the Utals, but you're going to have to because that's the deal, kind of thing. Because Magni does renounce his powers, doesn't he? Which is another weird, well, not kind of a weird, it was a very original take, because I'm sure even Peter Parker at his moment said, oh, I wish I wasn't Spider-Man because then my Uncle Ben would have been alive, that kind of thing. And I think it's just the guilt, even in Vidar's funeral, he's there praying in a church, well, not quite praying, but he's declaring to whatever universe is listening, like, please, can you just stop this now? I've had enough. I've taken a life. I don't like what you're making me do. Please stop. And how it all ends with that big lightning bolt that shatters the window, I thought that was just, that was dramatically well done.
But in the hero's journey, there is always a moment at which the hero gets to choose whether to walk away from the task or whether to get back to it and to go to the final showdown. So that's basically his three-act choice. It's at the end of the third act where he gets to give away his responsibility and then take it back again, because you know he's got to.
And you see it, I think, in the Thor of the Marvel comic universe, don't you, that he has moments where he doesn't want to go back to Asgard. He just wants to stay on Earth with his love interest and just be a regular guy. But then somebody shows up, as it might be Christopher Eccleston or somebody, and he has to get the hammer out again. So I think that sense of, you know, Lord, take this cup away from me. It's that moment Christ goes through in Gethsemane as well. Please don't make me suffer any longer like this. But to be a hero, you have to eventually make the choice to go on.
Have to reject it. Opens it out into kind of wider hero myths and superhero myths of the idea of the kind of the moment of giving up your power, whether that's voluntary or not, because sometimes it's your power is taken from you, obviously. So it is interesting that it's on purpose for him. It's much more of an abdication of responsibility than kind of an obstacle placed in his way. He's kind of placing the obstacle for himself.
I've got on my notes that it is in episode 5 of season 3 when Rotan's having that talk with Magni after they finally got the hammer back. And again, that was remarkably well done, because all the gods have united, some incredible scheme unfolds, and they managed to get the hammer back. And of course, that's when Laurits gets dressed up as Fjord as a decoy for the giants to get away. They don't quite manage it. Wotan is actually the remarkable one that bops Saxon on the head with his staff come spear and takes the hammer back. And as soon as Magni's got the hammer, he just walks off, muttering sweet nothings to his hammer and ignores absolutely everybody else. And I thought, oof, that would hurt if I was in that group. I would like, be like, what? I would have chased after him. So like, what are you doing? But when he's having that talk in the woods, he says these words, with special powers comes special responsibility. So it is very much, he literally does. And of course, as well as Kiwi, I've got that, let's say Kiwi. He was a fun character, becoming Heimdall, because they go through the initiation with the strange kind of like clawed orb thing that the Seeress has, gets given a whistle, his version of the Galahorn. Jenna, Laurits' love interest, becomes Balder because he is the only one that says, can we not just fight? Can we not just sit and talk to them? Because there's four of them, there's more of us, it's not going to be pretty. Do we really want to go through with this? Mm. And of course, it's Laurits who says, yes, but if you're Balder, that means you're going to die at some point. And I'm not happy with that.
I was just going to say, speaking of Jens, can we talk about the ending? Because I almost screamed. When that whole sequence started with the arrow, because like Louis mentioned earlier, I was like, okay, we're gonna fridge our gaze again. That's just what's happening. Yeah. I was actually pretty pissed when they revealed that Jens was Balder. I was like, he better not die. I'm gonna be so mad.
Yeah. I always wonder if they fridged the first gaze to make us believe they do it to Balder too.
That is a good point.
Like, that's we're capable of it, but we're gonna be a last minute reprieve.
Well, I think part of it was, and I thought it was a really great pushback against the concept of predestination. The fact that you can break the cycle if you want to, if you're motivated to do it. And I was thinking, okay, this is going to go one of two ways. I really hope that it's going to go this way, because otherwise the answer will be you can't break the cycle. Yeah. But you can. It's not necessarily comfortable to do it. It takes you into very uncharted waters. But on the other hand, this is progress. This is so that you don't have to go through the whole thing over and over again with different peoples in the same incarnations, that you've actually learned something and you can take it forward. And so this was why. I mean, I know a lot of people had real problems with that ending because it felt weird and unresolved, but actually it was supposed to be, to me, because otherwise the whole of that cyclic narrative ended up meaning nothing.
Though I think it was also about the acknowledging the tension between the mythic and the real, and quite allowing you to situate the story in one or the other. There's potentially that idea that maybe he was schizophrenic or had some kind of visions, but it doesn't come down on one side or the other firmly. And I quite like that because it's always been about the kind of porous nature of myth and real life. But I like that idea of the breaking of the cycle, and perhaps there's an element that in order to break the cycle of the past, you have to treat the past as fiction, you know, that the values of the past are not true anymore. And so that by kind of citing the mythical element in fiction, it allows you to kind of go on in the real world with a new myth, whatever you're making up, a new truth.
And taking the positives out of the old stories, I guess, the things that help you grow into the kind of person that you want to be.
Yeah.
Without necessarily... accepting this sort of polarization of good versus evil, or as Joanne says, that you're just doomed to repeat the same steps over and over again. And I, when I was watching the final episode, I was called to go and eat my dinner just before the last 15 minutes. And I ate my dinner down thinking, oh no, what's going to happen? I can't bear it. All these people I like so much. Oh no. And then I was very pleased by the way it resolved the ending. But at the same time, that then after that, it was, but I have questions. What was real or what was not real of what we saw? And did the people who died really die? I guess they did. Vidard certainly died. Isolde died. Merit, fed apparently to Jörmungandr by Vidar. I guess she died in a road accident or something. This kind of alternative reality becomes, if you start putting pressure on it, I think it might become quite difficult to live with. But as it is, since you have that resolution at the ending, you can go, okay, I'll take that, and now I'll move on.
I think I was seeing it as the mythic and the real kind of departing after a certain point. So everything that happened before that point did literally happen. But after that point, it's sort of a bit more open to interpretation. So that anyone died in that final sequence was fine. But if you died before that, then you just died, you know.
Including what? Sorry, Joanne, you go.
I sort of thought that we were seeing glimpses of a multiverse with a number of different potentials being played out in different ways with different interpretations onto them. So you could basically pick your ending in that way.
I love that's what they're doing,
and I quite like that. I think it's quite an audacious way of resolving a series, but it also opens up to personal involvement from the viewer, which I think is quite essential when we're talking about something that's that... you know, that, as you say, it's skirting the mythic without actually reenacting it fully.
Mm. And I like the idea of it kind of being a kind of filigree or superimposition of realities. And you kind of, yes, you say you can pick which reality you want to be in, or you can sit uncomfortably between the two and feel mm-hmm. slightly confused.
Having spoken to you all, it's made me think that in terms of how we talk about how it's a high school setting and it's about identity and finding yourself. Obviously, in episode 5 of season 3, they reach an understanding. They say, okay, we're not going to do this anymore. We're going to. I put my hammer down. I won't use it. You put your spears down. We adapt the new. We go forward. Then we all live happily ever after, kind of thing. And so they're kind of like the giants are deciding not to be follow tradition, follow the law, follow the old world, kind of thing. They adapt to the new. So Saxy gets her power. Fjord, he steps down, but he doesn't get Gree back. I don't think. No, I don't think he. Gets a new love interest.
She's gone.
Because she left very heartbroken. She was very much like Juliet, heartbroken. And of course, Ran just carries on being the school teacher. No great change for her. Magni just kind of like gets past his grades and succeeds, and so does Lauritz. And now it's a kind of like he settled in his identity. Everyone welcomes him. There's no judgment, no anything. And of course, he sets. Little S, okay, Jormungand, kind of like off into the deep blue sea. Okay, you go, you live your life now, Jormungand. You can't fit in this glacier, this fjord anymore. Go and live your life. But how does one say goodbye to the character of Thor? And I think the only way Thor can depart is through his comeuppance against Jormungand. And so when Magni comes across the comics and revisits the whole events of Ragnarok, he's effectively going step by step of pulling that essence of Thor out of him in a way, I think, kind of like he's taking Thor out of his identity by letting Thor have that climactic end, do what he was to do in according to canon law, and then he is now just Magni. He's almost like letting, so he doesn't really kind of like try to keep Thor alive, he just does it. But it, of course, I can understand how it confuses a lot of the viewers, thinking, oh my goodness, okay, they're now actually having this climactic ending, what's going on?
Yeah.
Because you're getting flashbacks to the Ragnarok scenes, and then flashbacks to them all kind of like clapping in the hall and saying, oh, congratulations, class of 2023, off you go, live your dreams, kind of thing. But it also relates back to his treatment of Sigyn, or is it Signy? I think it's Signy. Because of course, yes, when he's under the influence of Saga, she gets very, very badly treated, dear viewers. That is one way you do not treat your girlfriend. You do not kind of like not officially dump them and then go off with someone else. And so he's probably dealing with a lot of complex issues relating that, kind of like finding out how to deal with a relationship with a girl, because it certainly appears to me that he's never had that before. Whereas Lauritz is probably the more kind of like relationship confident compared to Magni. So that's what I think. But I can understand it did kind of like a calls for season 4, but also equal kind of like what was that kind of thing?
Well, on Reddit, which I was looking at today, a lot of people were saying they should have finished with episode 5 of season 3, that they agreed they weren't going to do this thing. And that would be that. That would be pretty anticlimactic. I can see that they had to find some way, as you say, of tying off the storylines. And I think your suggestion of kind of we don't need this anymore, that Thor is vanishing, as you say, Becky, out of Magna's life is really quite powerful, even if it does then lead to questions about, they all are living happily ever after. Kind of, except for the dead ones.
Yes.
But what was that we just saw? Well, that's what you have to go and take away and sit with, I think.
Louis, do you want to go first?
Okay. now I've forgotten what I was going to say. You go.
Oh, okay. Have you frozen or
no, okay. No, I forgot what I was going to say in the process.
We forgot what she was going to say.
I was just going to say that the whole thing with Thor and his journey, I think the reason we all felt it was slightly incomplete is probably the clue is probably in his name, because they chose not to name him Thor or something that made us think. So he's actually, so he's gone through the whole of Thor's journey, and he's now been reborn as Thor's son. And this makes sense when you look at the fact that Magni has daddy issues throughout the whole thing. He doesn't know his father. He doesn't know himself. He goes on this mythic journey to find himself and finds that he's actually not his father and that he can be Magni. And I think if you read it in that way, it becomes a more satisfying ending, because yes, he's going off into the unknown and he's left behind this mythic baggage, but it's also progress forward, which is why I think they gave him that name in a very particular way for that particular reason.
Because that is actually, does Magni survive the rebirth? I can't remember in terms of.
Yes, he does.
They do.
We don't know anything about what he does.
Yeah. I think it's very much. It goes back to the hammer being kind of a symbol of his adulthood, his manhood. Because at the very end, of course, like, he's graduating, he's coming into his adulthood, and he's leaving behind his comic books. And it's very much of a sense of, okay, we're leaving behind these childish things. And it all gets tied up with that theme of, I'm an adult now, and I'm Magni, and this is what I'm going to do with my life, and I can put all of this behind me, and I know who I am now. And so in that sense, like, I was very much in two minds of the finale. I really disliked it in terms of storytelling. I really wanted it to be real. And it still is real, the same way all myths are real. It's a story that tells us about ourselves. So I just really, I found it that I could accept it a bit more, the finale.
That's fine.
I kind of agreed. There's a bit in the poetic edda, though, isn't there, about the sons of Thor and the sons of the gods finding the discarded golden gaming boards of Asgard. And I thought that scene was absolutely about that. I thought, okay, this is them finding the toys that their parents played with and wondering what they were for, and then moving on. I mean, to me, it was a very moving symbolic depiction of that, putting aside those things and going, okay, they're not for me. I'm going to have something of my own.
Yeah.
And that sort of sit down by the fjordside restaurant all together there was very much like going back to the hall at the end of Erisberg.
Yes.
Sirius's prophecy, and remembering the old days, but now we're ready to move on to new, all those possibilities of a new beginning with adult life.
And when Isolde appears to Magni at the table, that I really teared up. I really loved that moment.
Me too.
Because back towards the beginning again, the cycle, and she vanishes, and that really is kind of the gateway of like, okay, I can put all this behind me now. I'm starting over. Isolde was real, and now she's gone, and it's okay.
Yeah,
but she's kind of with me. Yeah.
Okay, well, thank you so much. I would love to talk for hours and hours about this with you all, but we all have lives to live, and unfortunately we need to let our dear viewers go so they can go and watch season one, season two, season three. It's all there on Netflix. We do strongly recommend it. There are lots more things that happen that we haven't touched on. We haven't spoiled it too much. And so many of the characters. And I really appreciate all of you joining me today for another Valhalla Conversations on Ragnarok's Netflix series. Thank you so much, ladies. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for inviting us, Becky, and thanks for making me watch it as well.
Thank you. It's been great to see all of you. Thank you very much for being here too.
Yeah. Till next time.
Wonderful to meet you
again.